Your financial choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature, or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter, nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related penalties. For personalized advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
This is your host, Lori Siebert. Welcome to Your Financial Choices. Today is March 27th, 2019. Our topic tonight is extensions, amendments, and this and that. We are live tonight. We'll take your questions. Lori C. is in the studio with us this evening, and we'll answer your calls and take your information. And we're going to go with off-air questions tonight, but please feel free to call in. Lori will write the question down and bring it in to me in the studio. Again, the number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. And I'll do my best to answer your questions. We do discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments. And while I typically have a topic each week, you can still ask questions off topic, and I'll do my best to answer them. And you can also send questions through the website, yourfinancialchoices.com. So extensions, amendments, and this and that. Throw in a few things. And listeners' questions tonight, of course, at this time of year being tax season, people might have questions about their tax returns. I think it's a good opportunity to kind of open up the lines for questions if you have them. And you know, just give your question to Lori C. and she'll write that down and bring it into the studio. This is also the time of year where people may start to panic that they're not going to have all their information in order to file their tax return. What happens sometimes is we'll have people who will be waiting for certain tax documents, maybe a Schedule K-1. What is a Schedule K-1? A Schedule K-1 is a reporting document that comes from either a partnership, an S corporation, a trust. So that is how they report your share, either as a partner, a shareholder, or a beneficiary of the income from any of those entities. And their due dates for those tax returns are sometimes the same as a calendar year taxpayer, as you're, you know, as individuals. So it could be April 15th. Sometimes the states and trusts have fiscal year ends that are very different. So their due date might be May 15th. So the K-1s aren't always going to be on your same time schedule. Certain calendar year filers the business returns sometimes have a March 15th deadline, but they can extend their returns. So sometimes people have to wait for those K-1s, or they're going to come in at the last minute. Maybe you use a tax preparer who is going to be too busy April 10th to finish your return. So sometimes you have to file an extension for those reasons. Could be a K-1 you're waiting for. We just saw some K-1s come out just in the last day or two for some of the master limited partnership investments people have. So if you are someone who invests in a partnership, you know, certain organizations, investments, companies will have investments in those master limited partnerships, and they have K-1s that report investment income from those partnerships to their investors, and those K-1s sometimes dribble in at the end. So let's say you have to file an extension, or you're getting worried about filing an extension. Individuals do that with Form 4868. It's an application for an automatic extension of time to file their return. What I like to point out specially is that an extension of time to file is not an extension of time to pay. So an extension of time to file is not an extension of time to pay. So what they expect you to do is at least come up with an estimate of the expected tax that you would have, and pay that with your extension. So let's say you can ballpark the numbers for the most part, and you think you're going to owe maybe $1,000. Well, you're going to want to send that $1,000 in with your extension, with that Form 4868. So yes, the extension could be automatic, meaning you don't have to have a reason to do the extension, but you do want to send in your money. Now, one of the things that we look at for folks, especially people who maybe aren't working, they don't have withholdings through payroll, or they don't have withholdings through IRAs, but maybe they have a lot of investment income or income that's not getting taxed by an employer or by the IRA custodian. Maybe you're self-employed and you have to pay your taxes yourself. So either on investment income or self-employment income, and you're doing quarterly estimated tax payments. Well, if you're filing for an extension, that means you're not going to be able to file your tax return by April 15th. Well, you still would be obligated to start filing your quarterly estimated tax payments. April 15th is the first one. So typically what we will do is we will roll the first quarter estimate into the extension payment. So for example, if we think someone's going to owe $1,000 with their 1040, you know, using our ballpark numbers, and maybe they normally do a quarterly payment of, let's say, $2,000 a quarter. Maybe every year they have about $8,000 of tax, so they do $2,000 a quarter. That's $8,000. And so they have their $1,000 expected anticipated balance due for 2018, and we know they're going to have the $2,000 first quarter estimate. We will roll that into the extension payment. So now we have an extension with $3,000. In this way, if we file the tax return and they end up owing more than $1,000, at least we have their 2018 payment covered because of the extra money we put down with the extension. What would happen then is, let's pretend my $1,000 really turned into $1,500. Well, I did an extension payment of three. My bill was $1,500. I still have a $1,500 overpayment. And you know what we do with that then? That's what we apply to the estimated tax payments. And then we'll adjust the subsequent payments. All right? So extensions, not an extension of time to pay. It's just an extension of time to file. Very important to do. And why would we want to make sure we do an extension? What if we don't have the money to pay? Well, if we don't have the money to pay, we still want to file the extension because the penalties for failure to file or failure to file timely are, you know, can be quite hefty. And why have a penalty if you don't need one, if all you simply had to do was file this extension of automatic extension of time to file? Now, granted, if you owe $100,000, the IRS might not accept that extension. So you have to make a reasonable effort to pay with what you think you owe with that extension. Folks, we're having some calls come in, and I will take those questions as soon as we get back from our first break. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
WDIY offers many choices and real voices.
This is Tom Druckenmiller. Join me and our other folk music hosts each weekday evening from 7 to 9 and Sunday from 11 to 1 for a great mix of classic folk, bluegrass and old time, Celtic, blues and contemporary songwriters, plus interviews, concert information and more.
WDIY is the Lehigh Valley's local source for NPR news, public affairs and diverse music at 88.1 FM and streaming on WDIY.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices, and we're happy to take listeners' questions tonight. We just can't take you live on air, but you can call in and give your question to Lori C., and she'll write it down and bring it in to me. The phone number is 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. And we did have a question come in from Tom, and he had a question about the Form 5498 as it pertains to a health account and reporting. And I believe what Tom is referring to is a health savings account. So there is a form called the 5498 people get at the end of the year. It might come timely, it might not come timely, and it basically reports information related to your health savings account as to, I believe sometimes it's going to show the contributions to the health savings account that you've made. There's also a form that refers to the distributions. And I don't know all the numbers off the top of my head because I just look at the forms as we get them in. But basically, it may or may not be the may or may not be the employer who is putting that form together, because you also could be making contributions to a health savings account through, you know, not an employer. So it could be the custodian that holds the health savings account. And that is like an informational filing. But why it's important to know what you have for the health savings account is because if you are employed, you have a high deductible health plan. And because you have a high deductible health plan, you're eligible to open a health savings account. If you have a health savings account, you may have either a single or self-only plan, or you may have a family plan. Depending on if you have individual self-only coverage or family coverage, the amount that you can contribute to the health savings account will vary. So if you're single, I think it's off the top of my head like $3,450 in 2018. And if you have family coverage, it's $6,900. If you're over 50, it's an extra $1,000 that you could put into the plan. But basically, you make an election typically at open enrollment with your employer as to how much you're going to fund the health savings account through payroll deduction. Now, what I have seen is I have seen where people will say, well, the employer is going to put in $1,200 if I put in $1,200. So you do payroll deduction, let's say $100 a month. You put in $1,200, the employer put in $1,200. You're going to see a code W on your W-2 for the year 2018. You're going to look at your W-2. You say, hey, I have a health savings account. Lori just mentioned that, and I can see how much I put into it on my W-2. When you look at your W-2, there's a code W. That tells you what the employer contributions are, which include the employee contributions through payroll. So in that story, it's $2,400. Now, remember, I said if you're single, I think it's $3,450. If you're married, if it's a family plan, it's $6,900. Well, if in my W-2 code W, it shows I've only put in $2,400 and I could put in $6,900. I have an opportunity before April 15th of this year to put in money for the 2018 return. So in my story, $2,400, we could put in $6,900 in a family plan. That's $4,500 more. I could put in $4,500 more into my health savings account, get a deduction for it on my tax return for federal, and get a deduction on it in my Pennsylvania tax return. So when we talk about the reporting, Tom, of that Form 5498, it may have some valuable information, but here's what you have to pay attention to. I have had clients who go ahead and fund it outside of the employer plan because they didn't realize they could max it outside of their payroll. They could write a check and put it in up till April 15th of the year following. So up till April 15th, they can fund 2018. They fund it, and then when they get that form and it says what their contributions are for the year, it sometimes shows the prior year, you know, where you've done a catch-up contribution, where you've made up the difference. So you really want to kind of track your contributions. What I have seen clients do, which is wonderful, is they send me a form and they show their contribution and they say date, dollar amount, and the year they've done the contribution for. So I can very easily tie into the forms showing the contributions to make sure that we're not over-contributing, because you don't want to over-contribute because there's penalties for that. So very important form and coordinating with your W-2 to make sure that you're not overfunding, but certainly taking advantage of the full deduction if you have the means to do so. If you have the cash in the bank and you know you'd use it for medical expenses anyway, why not do it in such a way where you get a nice medical deduction for it? It's not a medical deduction. It's actually a reduction in your income right on your tax return. So that's for federal and Pennsylvania. Then you would have the opportunity at your next open enrollment period to say, hey, rather than me trying to scramble and remember to do that, I could just maximize it through payroll, and then it's automatically done, and you don't have to worry about catching it up. So if you have the means and the ability to maximize your health savings account, if you're eligible for that because you have a high deductible health plan, make sure you're taking advantage of that. So yes, you should have a form. Who is producing the form? I would expect it may be the employer, but it may be a custodian of the health savings account who's producing it. But Tom, you probably don't necessarily need that tax form for your tax return. It's informational. But if it helps you figure out how much you can contribute in additional amounts to the health savings account, it certainly could be an important piece of information. Now, what I have seen quite often is people will sign up for online statements and online, sign-on activity, et cetera. You may not get a paper form. So if you have an account, an online account, you might actually have to go into that account and look for tax reporting or tax documents or forms. It might be a drop down somewhere in the online site. All right, so that might be where it is. Okay, Tom, thank you for that question. Jay also called in, and Jay, I'm going to take your question after the next break because I've got about a minute to go, and I'm not sure I can answer it that quickly, so I will answer your question when we come back from the break. We are talking about extensions, amendments, this and that, and of course, listener questions, my favorite thing. I'm sorry we can't take live calls tonight, but certainly we can take your off-air calls, and Lori is busily writing down the questions. You just have to dial 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. And she'll write down the question, bring it into the studio to me, and I'll do my best to answer them. And we will continue in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
American folk music offers a variegated pattern of performers and styles. I'm Tom Druckenmiller, your host for In the Tradition. Together, we'll trace the roots and branches of American folk music from the earliest recordings and performers through today's talented players. In the Tradition, Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. Tom, real quick to your last questions, at the break, I quickly looked up the Form 5498 for the health savings account, and it is a 5498 SA. That's Sam Apple, SA, 5498. And that does show the total contributions and the made in the tax year. And in fact, it looks like they've updated the form, and it shows that they've added something, a total of HSA or Archer MSA contributions made in 2020 for 2019. So maybe the 2018 5498, say, contributions made in 2018 for 2017, and the 2018s will say, made in 2019. So that's good that they've got that on there. All right. And it's the trustee of the health savings account that is going to be responsible for completing that form or providing that form, producing that form. Okay. Folks, if you have questions, phone number is 610-758-8810. 610-758-8810. Jay from Macungie called, had a great question. He was inquiring about 529s, and I know I've had this question before, so it means it's a good question and a question that needs to be answered more regularly. And what he asked is there a tax advantage? And what he asked in particular that I've had other people say is, can he open it by April 15th for 2018? No, Jay, you cannot. So you cannot, that is not one of those things that you can do like an IRA. So IRAs, Roth IRAs, those health savings accounts, the IRS gives us until April 15th to make contributions to them and act like they're in the prior year, 2018. We cannot do that for 529. 529 is the Internal Revenue Code section that governs the college savings plans. That's why we call them college savings 529s. There is a tax advantage to them. 529s are really great tools for saving money for college, especially when you've got, you know, maybe a brand new baby and you have 18 years to save. That's really forward thinking. You start putting money away into a 529 account, and it's as it's invested and grows and has, you know, income and gains and, you know, interest and dividends and all of that stuff that happens when in your investment accounts, it just continues to grow, hopefully, and you can continue to contribute to it. You can do it, you know, one time, two times every year, monthly, however you want to set up to save for this in this 529. For federal, we don't get a deduction, but for Pennsylvania, we do get a deduction up to $15,000 per person per donee. So I could do $15,000 to my child. My spouse could do $15,000 to our child, and we could do it to three children. So you can really pack away a lot of money for college savings accounts. So there is a tax advantage as a deduction on Pennsylvania. The further tax advantage is if that money continues to grow, it's all tax deferred, and then it's going to be tax free if we use it for qualified education expenses. Qualified education expenses can be tuition, and it can also include room and board. So 529 accounts are a great way to have, you know, money grow and have it be income tax-free as long as you're using it for qualified education expenses. You asked what types are popular in Pennsylvania. Well, Pennsylvania, I think, does have some Vanguard funds now, but generally, you don't have to be tied to the particular state you live in necessarily. Certain states give deductions, like New York, if you go into the New York plan. Virginia, it might have to go into the Virginia plan. Pennsylvania gives a deduction for any state plan, and it doesn't even have to be your own child. I could put money in a 529 for, you know, my nephew, and as long as I have his name and social security number, I can get a deduction. It's really to encourage education and saving for education. So you really want to research what plan you're going to like the most. There are some plans that are advisor-based and some plans that are independent that are not advisor-based, and you can just go on, you know, their website and sign up for it. There's also 529s that are guaranteed typically through the state. That's a different kind of animal. But a great website to go on to compare the different kinds of 529s and the, you know, the bells and whistles of each is savingforcollege.com. That's savingforcollege.com. Lots of other valuable information there as well. You had asked, should you open a 529 or just invest the money to be used for schooling later? Well, here's another new advantage to 529s that we didn't have before, and that is they, with the recent tax reform, they expanded the use of 529s to also be used for private school education for elementary or secondary education. So if you have children who are attending a private school, you can use money out of the 529 for tuition up to $10,000. So if your kids are going to a private school and tuition is $3,000, you can use $3,000 of the 529 for your child's tuition. If the tuition's $12,000, you can only use $10,000. So that's another advantage. But I understand some people get a little nervous, like what happens if my child doesn't go to college? What happens if my child gets a scholarship? What if something happens to my child? Do I want to put all my eggs in that one 529 basket? Well, a number of things can happen with the 529s. Number one, you can always change the beneficiary on it. If you end up where your child gets a scholarship, like my middle daughter who had a full ride, one of the exceptions to the, there is a penalty if you take the money out for something other than qualified education expenses. You have to pay the tax on the earnings, and you would have to pay a 10% penalty on those earnings. So you're not paying a tax or a penalty on the amounts you put in. Let's you put, say you put in $50,000 and it grew to $80,000. I have $30,000 of gain. If my child ended up, let's say I decided to buy a car. Well, that's a total disqualified use. I would have to pay the tax on the $30,000 of income, and I'd have to pay a 10% penalty on the $30,000. So I'm no worse off as far as the income tax than I would be if I had invested outside, but I would be worse off on the 10% penalty. So the IRS gives us some exceptions to that 10% penalty. The exceptions are, well, if your kid gets a scholarship, well, then if the scholarship was $20,000, I could pull $20,000 out. There still would be a tax on the earnings. I just have an exception to the 10% penalty. So they give us some exceptions to that. But you can always, again, change the beneficiary on it or pass it on to your child. If they ended up not needing it, they could use it for their children. So you can let those go, I think, another generation. But if you're nervous about it completely, you could kind of do a little bit of both, hedge a little bit. You could always do some in a 529 and maybe do some in a special account held aside that if, but maybe in your name. The issue with putting any accounts in kids' names is when you go to file for financial aid, if there's any chance that your child would be eligible for financial aid, the child's assets are going to count at a greater percentage of availability than the parents' assets. So the 529 account, you know, would be in your name, the owner as a parent. But if you decide not to put it all in the 529, you might want to just kind of put it in another special account. And a lot of times custodians, the major custodians, they can let you put like a moniker on the account, like a name where you could say, you know, special account, education. And it doesn't mean it's a 529 account. It just means that it's set aside for that purpose later. And that way, if your child doesn't go to college, you still have that other money set aside. Or if, you know, if they need to buy a car or, you know, something out of the ordinary, you're not having to pull money, taking a disqualifying distribution from the 529. You can use money out of that other account for some of those purposes. All right, Jay? So I hope that helped. Manish from Brynacksville, I got your question, and I will also take your question after this next break because we're coming up on the halfway point, and I see you have some questions about some education as well. So that's very interesting. It'll piggyback very well off of the 529 discussion that we just had. So folks, if you have questions, I love the questions. I love listeners' questions, and these are good questions tonight. I really appreciate it because it's a beautiful night, and I appreciate you taking the time to listen. The phone number is 610-758-8810. Again, that's 610-758-8810. Just call and give your question to Lori. She'll write it down, and she'll bring it in to me. We'll be back in just a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
WDIY 881, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. You're listening to Your Financial Choices with Lori Siebert. Your Lehigh Valley weather, currently it's 51 degrees. Tonight will be mostly clear with a low around 27. Tomorrow, Thursday, sunny high with a high near 58. Thursday night, showers kind of move in, some sprinkles early and then showers overnight. Otherwise, mostly cloudy, low around 41. Friday, a chance of showers, mainly after 3. Mostly cloudy, high near 64. Showers Friday night. And then Saturday, it warms up a bit, and we're going to have temperatures close to 70 degrees. Pretty nice. So now we'll turn it back to you, Lori, and your financial choices.
Thank you, Norm. Welcome back, folks. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. 10, we are talking about extensions, amendments, and this and that. And that's this is part of the this and that. Listeners, if you have questions, the Lori C is in the studio, and she will take your question, write it down, and bring it into me. The phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. So Manish from Bryanxville called, and he asked about taking a tax credit for student expenses such as a laptop, computer cables, etc. He has a high school student. Can you use this if standard or just for itemized? I think there's a few things getting kind of mixed up here just a little bit. When we talk about tax credits, we're usually talking about, when we talk about students, we're talking about tax credits for college students typically, or kind of lifetime learners, you know, bachelor's degree, graduate degrees, long-term learners, lifetime learners, I should say. So there's certain education tax credits for those kinds of expenses, which I'll talk about in a moment. And some of it can be eligible if there's some computer equipment. It depends on which education credit or which education benefit you're talking about. So I always tell folks, whatever education benefit you think you might be entitled to, or you want to review and research each of them because they're very different. There's very different qualified education expenses for each one. But the point here was you said you have a high school student. So the high school student, there is not going to be an education credit for a high school student if it is your high school student who has these expenses. If it is all in relation to the 529 account I mentioned earlier with the tax reform that allows you to take money out up to $10,000, that's strictly for tuition, not anything else that I'm aware of so far. So if your high school student has a laptop or computer cost, that's not going to be covered under a 529 distribution, and it's not going to qualify for any education credits. Now, you mentioned, can you use this if standard deduction or just for itemized deduction? So when prior to the Tax Reform Act, there was something called miscellaneous itemized deductions, that if you itemized your deductions, meaning if you itemized certain expenses, they were more than a standard deduction, you may get a benefit from miscellaneous itemized deductions. This is pre-2018. And if you were working and you had unreimbursed business expenses that might have included a computer or a home office or mileage, or if you were enhancing your job skills by taking some classes, or taking classes, whether it was for a degree or not for a degree, just taking classes to improve yourself, certain of those expenses would be miscellaneous itemized deductions before. So first of all, you had to be over a certain threshold, and then, you know, they had to be kind of qualifying expenses. So that's where we might have saw certain expenses, education expenses, as an itemized deduction. So Manish, I think there's just a number of things here going on that that you had to kind of just do a handwritten question here. I don't think it's going to help with your high school student. No expenses that I'm aware of that would be deductible. And I hope I understood your question correctly and that we got to answer that right. Real quick, to kind of close the loop on some of these education things, there is the American Opportunity Credit. That's typically the first 4 years of undergraduate work. Sometimes kids go to school 5 years. This credit is only available for four. So you can qualify for it for 4 years if you're within certain income and have, you know, out-of-pocket expenses. We mentioned the 529 account. What we have to be careful with is coordinating the education benefits that are available to us, because it is an education benefit to be able to take money out of the 529 account and not pay tax on it when we use it for qualified education expenses. I cannot double dip and use those same qualified education expenses for the American Opportunity Credit. So a quick example, if my education expenses are my qualifying education expenses for the 529 are $10,000, and I take $10,000 out of my 529 account, well, then I don't have any other education expenses available for any of the other credits. However, if I paid $4,000 out of pocket for tuition and $6,000 for my room and board out of the 529 account, I have $4,000 out of pocket. I could qualify for a $2,500 American Opportunity Credit if my income was below the filing requirements and it's my, you know, qualifying dependent, et cetera, et cetera. So that's, we have to coordinate the education benefits available. The Lifetime Learning Credit is one. My daughter's working on her master's degree. She qualifies for the Lifetime Learning Credit. She's paying her tuition. She's working. She has income tax. So it's to the extent of 20% of the first $10,000 and up to the amount of tax. So a Lifetime Learning Credit is a great mechanism to use for those adult students who go back to school, for example, for their graduate degrees, their master's degrees, or their PhD, and they're working and they have income tax. That's a nice little credit. Again, there's income limitations on that depending on your filing status. A number of other education credits, but always good to make sure that if you think you're going to be eligible for either yourself, a spouse, or a dependent in your family, who are engaging in any kind of education, you might want to make sure you explore that and research to see if you would be entitled to any education benefits. All right. Hey, folks, if you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. Just give your question to Lori and she'll bring it in to me. So we started at the top of the show talking about extensions. Just want to remind folks that's a Form 4868. There are a couple special rules for people who are serving in a combat zone or a qualified hazardous duty area, and for people who are living outside the United States. So if you're living outside the United States, and or serving in a combat zone, you qualify for an automatic 2-month extension, meaning you actually don't even have to file for that extension. You have till June, to April 15th, May, June, 2 months, June 15th, to file your tax return. And then you can even extend beyond that. So you are allowed an automatic 2-month extension to file your return and pay federal income tax if you're a U.S. citizen or resident alien and on the regular due date of your return, you're living outside the United States and Puerto Rico, and your main place of business or post of duty is outside the United States. So we have U.S. citizens who are working in Spain. We had someone working in England. Their due date of their tax return is June 15th. Okay. Certain other businesses, estates, trusts, they have different forms to file for extensions. So you just have to look that up if that is applicable to you. Interestingly, they talked about filing your extension, but also paying, as I mentioned earlier, you want to pay any anticipated tax due at that time. And if you want, you could roll over a first quarter estimate in that payment with your extension. They talked about using the EFTPS system. And I got to tell you, I mean, I'm a CPA and I don't really know a whole lot about this. It's the Electronic Federal Tax Payment System. Maybe because we get so nervous about, you know, our data getting hacked or something, it just maybe makes you a little nervous. But the IRS encourages people, and they say it's the easiest way to pay all your federal taxes through the EFTPS system, the Electronic Federal Tax Payment System. It's a system for paying federal taxes electronically using the internet or by phone using the voice response system. And it's offered free by the U.S. Department of Treasury. Now, what I found interesting is it makes it sound like it's very easy. And for those people who are last minute kind of people, you might think, oh, that's great. I can pay it online. I'll just go in at the last second, you know, minutes before midnight and pay because they have this wonderful electronic federal tax payment system. Well, it sounded to me like it takes quite a while to make sure, well, in our day and age, it takes a little while to get yourself set up on that. So when I went on their website, welcome to EFTPS, online, it says new to our website, and you can either enroll or make a payment if you've already set up an account. But what you have to know is that, let's see, I'm reading it as I'm looking at it. Electronic Federal Tax Payment System is a payment service. It's provided free by the U.S. Department of Treasury. After you've enrolled and received your credentials, you can pay any tax due to the IRS using the system. It says, you asked and we listened, and it was recently updated based on feedback from users. You can receive your confirmation by email. You can verify the bank account that will be used when making a payment. You can change the bank account used for a payment. You get a self-select your PIN when creating an additional enrollment, and you can terminate an enrollment you are no longer using. They want you to remember that they really value your privacy and security. They say they'll never contact you via email. If you receive an email that claims to be from the EFTPS tax payment service or for a sender you don't recognize, then you need to report it to phishing@irs.gov. But they do say you have to be enrolled. To enroll, you click on the enrollment on the website page and you follow the steps they've outlined. If it's the first time you're enrolling, you need to have your information validated by the IRS. It says after this process is complete, you'll receive a personal identification number via the U.S. mail in 5 to 7 business days at your IRS address of record. So here again, it looks like a great system. I'm sure it is a great system. It's just not something you can do like overnight because they have to mail, apparently, your PIN to you. So that could take 5 to 7 days. It says payments using the website or the voice response system must be scheduled by 8 p.m. the day before the due date. So there again, it gets a little nerve-wracking when you think you're going to make a payment and you can go online and just do it. You know, we get so used to paying bills online and doing it instantaneously, you might think that this is an instantaneous system as well, and it's absolutely not. So think ahead, work ahead. Maybe it's something you could think about setting up just in case. But you go online to the IRS, just type in EFTPS, and I'm sure that it'll take you to their welcome page that will help guide you through enrolling. I'm sure you're going to need things like your social security number and bank information to sign up. But they're going to send you a PIN, and at what point that PIN becomes you know, usable for what purpose, I don't know, because I've never used the system. All right, but can't do it overnight. Make sure you have it ready, and if you're going to pay, you want to have the money ready the night before. All right, so that is filing for extensions, folks, and ways to pay with the electronic federal tax payment system. When we come back from this next break, if we have calls, I'm happy to take those questions. 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. In lieu of questions, I will talk for a little bit about amending tax returns, especially for anyone who might have something still lurking out there from 2015, because you're running out of time. We'll be back in just a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services, including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Not only is becoming a WDIY member a great way to support the programs you love, it has its benefits. WDIY members have access to our weekly member ticket giveaway emails, discover great concerts, theater performances, film screenings, and more, all while supporting the many choices and real voices on WDIY. Make your gift today at 610-694-8100, extension 7, or wdiy.org. Thank you.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. The phone number this evening is 610-758-8810. You can call and give your question to Lori C. She'll write it down and bring it into the studio, and I'll do my best to answer the question. If you didn't get through tonight or have a more complicated question, you can always send it through the website, yourfinancialchoices.com. So we're talking about extensions for people who think they might not get their return done in time. Maybe they're waiting for information or they're just too overwhelmed. That's a Form 4868. You can go online and do it, and you can make a payment through their wonderful system, the Electronic Federal Tax Payment System, which I've explained moments ago. Let's talk about amended returns for a minute. One thing that happens when you're looking at, when you're doing your 2018 return, sometimes you'll go back and you'll compare it to your 2017 return, trying to gather all your information, and all of a sudden you realize you forgot something or you missed something. Well, you might found that you could have itemized and you didn't realize, you didn't make the connection, and you had way more medical expenses than you thought in the last year, and you kind of forgot about it. Well, you can amend your tax return for up to 3 years, including extensions. So why I like to talk about amended returns is, on occasion, you will find, if you go back to your 2015 tax return, so we have 3 years, I told you, right? So 2015 tax returns were due in April 15th of 2016. So a 2015 return was due April 15th of 2016. There might have been a couple extra days then. I don't remember, because it's not always April 15th. And we have 3 years to amend, so that would be 2019. If there were any deductions or tax credits or the such, maybe you didn't know about American Opportunity Credit, or you didn't know about all these education credits until you just heard me talk about them right now, and you said, hey, Johnny was in school in 2015. Our income wasn't that high. Maybe we would qualify for that American Opportunity Credit back in 2015, and we never did it. Well, you could go pull out your tax return, pull out your 1098-T, pull out the 1099-Q from 529 distributions, whatever it might be, the tuition statement from the college. Look to see if you would qualify, whether it's that or itemizing your deductions, or, you know, you missed, a capital loss or something. You can amend those tax returns up till 3 years after the due date. If it was due April 15th of 2016, you have until April 15th of 2019. You want to get that tax return amended. You can't file those electronically. You have to paper file. Typically what I do is, if you've used software, you go into the software that you originally used, click a button for amended return, put in the changes, print out the amended return, compare it to the original return, and you only send in to the IRS any pages that changed. And then you sign your return and mail it in. You don't want to wait if you had one for 15. You have a little more time for 16 and 17. But it never hurts to go back and look. I mean, even CPAs and preparers can miss things from time to time. That's why it's always good to kind of look at a two-year comparison, where you kind of can eyeball the numbers and the changes. So amended returns. So you can amend a return for 3 years. Now, I also said 3 years from the due date, including extensions. You got to be careful with this one, because let's pretend you amended filed your return for 2015. You extended it. So the due date would have been April 15th. I said including extensions. The extensions would have been October 15th, because we have 6-month extension. But you filed it in June. Well, the IRS gives you 3 years from the due date of the return or the filing date of the return, including extensions. So even though you extended it, you filed it on June 15th in my story, then you actually would only have till June 15th of 2019. So if you filed in March, you have till April 15th. So you have 3 years from the due date or the file date, I'll say, including extensions. But you don't have till the extension due date if you filed before the extension due date. So amended returns, something to think about and check out. And where I really find, I think, where people miss things, where I see returns that have to get amended, sometimes people will have a capital loss on an investment, and they might think, why bother reporting it? It was a loss anyway. Well, the IRS has the sale proceeds reported to them, and they don't know sometimes what your cost basis was. More and more they do, but historically, you know, securities purchased pre-2012, the IRS doesn't have that cost basis reported to them, so they don't know what the cost basis might be on the sales you had. So if you had a sale and maybe you thought it was a loss, you didn't need to report it. If the IRS hasn't already, you know, sent you a notice, you might want to amend the return if, well, you have to amend the return if you didn't report it anyway, because if you had a gain, you need to report it, but especially if you had a loss, because that loss could be valuable to you carrying forward. Capital losses you can use first against other capital gains, and to the extent they don't, you know, to the extent the capital loss exceeds your gains, you can use an additional $3,000 against your ordinary income and then carry the balance forward until you use it all. So sometimes those capital losses may not benefit you in a particular year and you think, well, why bother? I don't need it. But it could help you in a subsequent year. Maybe you don't have income currently, but what if you inherited something or you, all of a sudden you're taking money out of your IRAs? You could use some of the capital loss carryovers. If you don't have other capital gains, you can use up to $3,000 against ordinary income. So I see sometimes people miss that. People sometimes miss depreciation on, you know, if they have a rental property or they have maybe a business and they're using their home office and they've not depreciated their home office or have not depreciated maybe equipment, a computer or some such thing. So I've seen where sometimes taxpayers forget about certain deductions they'd be entitled to relating to business property or investment property. Another, I think, item for review is if you're self-employed and you have individual health insurance coverage. For a lot of years, people really weren't benefiting that much from the health insurance deduction, or perhaps maybe you were on a spouse's health insurance plan and now you're on your own, or your spouse retired and you have, you know, maybe you even have Medicare, but you're self-employed. If you're self-employed and you have individual coverage, including Medicare or supplemental plans to Medicare that are outside of a group plan, outside of an employer plan, that health insurance is a deduction for self-employed people, you know, limited by income, of course. So if you have self-employment income, you can get a deduction for self-employed health insurance. I see more and more people who might retire from their regular life, regular jobs, and go on to do consulting, and they're no longer employed. They no longer have employer insurance. They're self-employed. If they're paying for that health insurance, that is a deduction. It's not a deduction on Schedule C. It's a deduction against total income. So you can't lower your self-employment income, but you get a deduction on what I would call page one in the old days, page two now. But one that a lot of people forget about is the Medicare is automatically counted as individual coverage, and it can be both. If you're married, it can be the husband and the wife. And some people don't realize that either. They think, oh, I'm self-employed, I can deduct my health insurance, and they don't realize they can deduct the spouse's health insurance as well. Again, if it's Medicare or if it's an individual plan, if the spouse has employer coverage, that does not count. So that would be something to review and decide, do you want to amend your tax return? That could be some nice tax savings, depending on how much your health insurance is and how much income you have, what tax bracket you're in. If you work with someone to amend a tax return, you want to make sure that the tax benefit is going to be enough to warrant paying someone to prepare an amended return for you. So keep that in mind. In fact, that brings me to another point. If you get a corrected 1099, folks, you have, you know, investment statements coming from all these custodians, and you filed your tax return, it's all done, it's accepted, your refund's in the bank, or your check cleared, and all of a sudden you get a corrected 1099, and you think, oh man, I'm going to have to amend my tax return, I'm so upset, you know, they sent this corrected 1099 after I already filed my tax return. Well, if it's not a material amount, you probably won't have to file an amended return or change anything. And I don't have it on the tip of my tongue. I think May talked about it a couple of weeks ago. If the change is, I believe, less than $100 of tax, I think it was, you don't have to amend the return. What I sometimes will tell people, if it seems immaterial, you can forego filing an amended return, and if the IRS is interested in contacting you, they'll send you a notice. So if your dividends changed $40, the IRS probably isn't going to care. It's immaterial. If it was material, they would send you a notice. Now, the nice benefit of filing an amended return first is, first of all, if you find something material and substantial, you need to amend your return and let the IRS know, whether it's income or deduction. But if it's an income issue and there's income you found you didn't report, you forgot to report it, oops, you need to file an amended return to report the income. And if you file the amended return first, the IRS, I think if you file it within a year of discovering it, the IRS will not charge you penalties. So that's the incentive and advantage of filing an amended return in the circumstance where you have discovered income that you inadvertently missed reporting. It could also be if you inadvertently overstated expenses. So maybe you overstated a deduction and you shouldn't have, and now you caught it. File an amended return, say, oh, so sorry, we inadvertently duplicated this entry, we inadvertently reported this, and you just tell the IRS what happened on the amended return. File the amended return. If you owe more, you pay the tax. If you get a credit, you get a refund. And if you do get a refund on the amended returns, there is a way to track your refund, your amended return, on their website now, too. Before, we could only track the status of our refunds on our current tax return, but now we can actually track the status of refunds on amended tax returns, and that's all available on the IRS's website. In fact, if you are waiting for a refund and you had that, you could do irs.gov right now, and that's the first thing that comes up. Chip, I don't know if I can get to this question quick enough. Health savings account, what constitutes a family? He was 22-year-old daughter dependent or on his health care. Chip, if you have a high deductible health plan through work, and high deductible health plan is, you would know if you have a high deductible health plan. There's certain criteria around it. And if you have a high deductible health plan, then typically your employer would also have a health savings account option available to you such that you can make contributions to that. And the family plan would mean you have a family health plan, a family high deductible health plan. That's what I'm talking about with the health savings account. So for folks who have those, a lot of times we see younger people have those because they don't expect to have a lot of medical expenses. When we're older, sometimes we have so many medical expenses that we don't want those high deductible plans because maybe it would be too much out of pocket. But if you have one, health savings accounts are a great way to save money and get tax deductible, you know, that income is not taxable from your payroll. So Chip, I hope that helped. And yes, it's whoever's on that health plan. It could be your 22-year-old daughter because we can cover our kids till 26. Folks, next week we have Charles Stopp of Steckel & Stopp to discuss special elections and situations in PA inheritance tax filings. I want to really thank the listeners tonight. I really appreciated the questions. They were wonderful. Thank you, Lori. Thank you, Norm. Coming up next, we have Tom Druckenmiller with In the Tradition Folk Music. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive. Make the best of your financial choices and have a great week.